Fire Logic by Laurie J. Marks. Copyright 2002. This recording is read by the author and is copyright 2007. This is the first part of Chapter 1 of Fire Logic.
In the border regions of northern Shuftal, the peaks of the mountains loom over hard scrabble farmholds. The farmers there build with stone and grow in stone, and they might even be made of stone themselves. They are so sturdy in the face of the long, bitter winter that comes howling down at them from the mountains. The stone town of Kisha would have been as insignificant as all the northern towns, if not for the fact that Maccabee, the first Gedean, had lived and died there. His successor, Lilter, had discovered the manuscript of the book in which were laid out the principles that were to shape Shuftal. During the next 200 years, the library built to house the Maccabee manuscript had transformed the humble town into an important place, a town of scholars and librarians, who gathered there to study and care for the largest collection of books in the country. The library had in turn spawned a university, and the scholars, forced to live in the bitter northern climate, tried to make their months of shivering indoors by a smoky peat fire into an intellectual virtue. Emil Paladin considered frostbite a small price to pay for the privilege of being a student in the university at Kisha. He was older than some of the masters, and his longtime teacher, Peril Truthkin, had warned him that he might be more learned as well. For 10 years since his first piercing, Emil had accompanied Peril on the rounds of his territory, capturing fleeing wrongdoers and occasionally executing them when it was necessary. It was Peril who had finally arranged Emil's admission and who would be paying his fees. So now Emil had arrived for the spring term with a letter of introduction that was about to bring him into the presence of the Maccabee manuscript itself. Despite expensive carpets, rooms crammed with books, and fires that burned year-round to prevent the damp, the library was a chilly and echoing place where men and women in scholars' robes tiptoed about. Being admitted to the Maccabee manuscript, which set forth the principles that now unified Shuftal, was like being admitted into a temple. As he put on the silken gloves that he was required to wear, it occurred to Emil that Maccabee himself would have found this ritual tremendously peculiar. The first Gedean had been an obscure potato farmer who sat by a peat fire all winter long, writing of mysteries in a crabbed, nearly unreadable handwriting. The paper, Emil had been told, still smelled of peat. He doubted that the frowning librarian would let his nose come close enough to the paper for him to sniff it, but still Emil felt almost giddy with anticipation. A door opened, and the sound of an urgently ringing bell intruded on the silence. The librarian turned her head, frowning. "What?" she breathed at the man who hurried towards her. The man whispered in her ear. Paling, she turned aside and hurried away. Emil was left with the gloves on his hands and the door to the Maccabee vault still bolted shut. He felt a tearing, a sense of loss so profound he could not believe it had anything at all to do with the manuscript. Something momentous had happened. Dazed, he went through the halls, following the sound of the bell, out into the square that fronted on the library. As the bell continued to ring, the square became crowded with scholars, carrying pens with the ink still wet on the nibs, librarians carrying books, townsfolk wearing work aprons with babies in their arms and tools in their hands, and farmers from the countryside in heavy, muddy boots with satchels on their shoulders. The farmers must have spotted the messenger on the road and followed him into town to hear the news. The messenger's dirty, ragged banner hung limp from the bell tower, and Emil could scarcely make out the single glyph imprinted on it. It was death and life, he realized finally, which was commonly depicted on glyph cards as a pyre into which a man stepped and became a skeleton, or alternately from which a skeleton stepped and became a man. It was the Gadeans' glyph carried through Shaftal only once in each Gadean's lifetime, when the previous Gadean died and the new one was vested with the power of Shaftal. It called the people to simultaneously mourn and rejoice. Soon the messenger would announce the death of Harald Gadean, who had given the land protection and health for 35 years, and would name his successor. Emil did not envy the young elemental selected to inherit that burden of power and decision. The government of Shaftal had been in discord for some years, and the coastal regions were occupied by foreigners who lacked the paladin compunctions over the use of violence. This was a time that demanded wisdom, and the new Gadean would not have much leisure to learn it. A townswoman with a child clinging to her leg turned to Emil and said anxiously, "Well, it's a pity about Harald. But what I want to hear is the name of his successor. It would relieve my heart to know that the rumors we've heard are wrong." "Rumors," said Emil. "I'm sorry, I was isolated all winter and have only just come into town." "Well, they say that even though Harald has known since autumn that he was dying, he refused to name a successor. Surely he did it at the end, though. He'd change his mind when he felt the breath of death at his heels. And now all this Sinite nonsense will come to an end at last, for a young Gadean won't fear to act against them." The bell stopped ringing. The messenger, whose road grimy clothing had once been white, stood up on the bell platform to speak, but he could utter only a cracked whisper that those closest to him could scarcely hear. The people pushed a big man forward to stand beside him and listen to his broken voice, then shout his words in a voice that carried across half the town.
"Harald Gadean is dead."
The gathered people nodded somberly.
"He vested no successor," the big man boomed.
Some listeners groaned and others cried out in dismay, but Emil stood silent in horror. It was unimaginable that a Gadean would allow the accumulated power of 10 generations of Earth Witches to die with him.
"The House of Lilterways has fallen in a Sinite attack," the big man shouted.
His words were heard in stunned silence, followed by an outcry of shock and grief that swelled to fill the square. The big man's final words could scarcely be heard. "No one survived." From every quarter, the townspeople shouted frightened, frenzied questions. The messenger sank down onto the bell platform and replied in his broken whisper,
"I don't know. I don't know. I don't know."
Emil had already stripped off his silk gloves and now handed them to a nearby librarian, the same one who had been about to admit him to the vault.
"What will become of us?" she cried.
"Shaftal is at war," he said. He pushed his way through the weeping crowd and headed for the nearest paladin charter house, where he knew the members of his order would gather. He noticed that he himself was weeping, though except for that first tearing sensation in the library, he felt nothing. It was a small thing, insignificant beyond notice, that the fall of the House of Lilterways had severed Emil's soul, separating the scholar from the soldier, leaving his heart on the steps of the library, while his duty called him away to war. At the edge of the crowded square, an old man and a young woman observed the aftermath of the messenger's terrible news. Though they did not look like anyone else in the square, they were distinctly similar to each other, small-framed where the Shaftali were sturdily built, dark-skinned where the Shaftali were fair, with eyes and hair black as obsidian, where the townsfolk were generally tinted the color of earth. In dress also they stood apart as strangers, wearing long tunics of finely woven goat's wool, and jerkins and leggings of deerskin, while the working people wore breeches and long shirts. Both had long hair plaited and knotted at the backs of their heads. Let loose from its bindings, the young woman's hair would have brushed her thighs, and the man's hair would have reached his knees. Even their faces were shaped differently from those of the townsfolk, narrow and pointed, with hollows under the cheekbones and eyes set deep in shadow. With their pack animals tethered nearby, the two strangers stood beside a pile of beautifully woven blankets and rugs. When the messenger first arrived, they had been negotiating a large sale to a trader of woolens. The old man turned from his consideration of the weeping crowd to speak quietly to his companion in a subtle singing language. "So we cross the boundary into a new world," she said. "But I feel the earth is dissolving away before us, like a crumbling ledge above a crashing cataract." "Every boundary crossing feels like this," the old man said. "When we cross a boundary, it is a loss, a death, an ending. It always seems unendurable. It always seems like plunging over a cliff." He added kindly, "Zanja Natarwain, what has happened here portends a future that is more yours than mine. It is not too late to change your mind and refuse the gods." Though she was young, her face did not seem much given to laughter. She smiled, though, ironically. "How shall I do that? Shall I unlearn all I have learned these last 2 years? Shall I tell Salosa that now I have seen the world beyond the mountains, I want nothing to do with it?" "You could," he suggested. "The mountains protect our people like a fortress. You might retreat behind those walls and never come out again." "No, speaker," she said, seriously and respectfully. "I could not." They stood silently for a long time, watching the crowd divide into arm-waving, wildly talking clusters. The youths sent from the farms left to bear their news to the waiting elders. Zanja imagined the people of the entire country standing about like this, bereft and bewildered. She said, "Now the Sinites will overpower them, like wolves overpower sheep." Her people got their wool from goats, who were brave and clever and sure-footed. She had no admiration for sheep. The speaker said, "No, I think not. Perhaps the Shaftali people are not wolves, but neither are they sheep." The trader finally remembered his visitors and their pile of woolens and came over, wringing his hands. I don't know what to say to you. Ushawala e woolens are a luxury, and I don't know if I can sell luxuries to a country at war."
the speaker said dryly, "Good sir, this land has been occupied by Sinites for 15 years, yet you never had any difficulty selling your wares before." But now the house of Lilterways has fallen." The man could not continue. "Come back tomorrow," he finally said in a choked voice. I need to consider my future." "I am considering whether the Oshawala'i people would be better served if we sold their woolens to a more decisive trader, one who will not make us spend an entire afternoon unpacking and repacking with nothing to show for it." He gestured, and Sanja, who understood the value of drama, began painstakingly and with evident weariness to roll up the large, beautiful rug over which they had been dickering. The trader thought better of his caution, and money changed hands. As they led their string of sturdy horses away, the old man commented, "We will travel more lightly now." The speaker had said he would bring her to the house of Lilterways to introduce her to its most important residents, Mabon, the council head, the other 11 councillors representing the orders of Lilterways and each of the regions of Shaftal, and Harald Gedeon himself. Now the house of Lilterways was rubble. The 12 councillors were dead, and so was Harald Gedeon. Zanja asked, "But where will we travel to?" The speaker did not answer. They walked down one of the town's main streets until they reached a place where an inn stood on one side of the road, and on the other side stood a Lilterways charter house. The yard was busy with horses being saddled, and armament and supplies being distributed to a company of paladins. Most of them seemed very young, not yet pierced with the first gold earring that would mark the day they took their vows to spend their lives in service to Shaftal. Their senior officer, a woman whose two earrings glittered in the bright spring sun, came over to the fence. "That's a fine string of animals you've got there. The paladins have need of them." "I am the speaker for the Oshawala'i before the Council of Lilterways, and these are the only horses and donkeys owned by my people. Without them, the trade between my people and yours would come to an end." "That seems a small matter when the world is coming to an end." "It is not a small matter." The speaker leaned his elbows unconcernedly on the fence. "And you will not take my people's stock, for we are protected under the law." "What do we know anymore?" the commander muttered. "Isn't it against the law for children to ride to war? Isn't it against the law for the house of Lilterways to be turned to rubble?" She turned rather agitatedly to shout something at someone. "You may borrow our donkeys," said the speaker, "if we accompany them." "We ride out on paladin's business." "It is the speaker's duty to advise and protect our people. For that we must know all we can about events in Shaftal. And we are Katrim, warriors like yourself with vows to fulfill. We will observe and not interfere, and perhaps we might even be of some help." The commander looked at them. She saw two schooled faces and disciplined stances. The speaker's hands had many small scars of a kind a blade fighter might get in practice bouts. His young companion's hands were scarred also, though not as heavily. Both of them had a rather unnerving quality to their gazes, an intentness and seriousness that seemed almost unnaturally alert and intelligent. Perhaps these two had elemental talents. In any case, they almost certainly would be valuable companions. the commander said, for she was desperate for beasts to carry the gear of war. We ride to a gathering of paladins, and after that we ride against the Sinites. Come with us if you like, but I can't promise your safety or the safety of your animals. Seeming amused, the speaker accepted her terms. Sunja Natarwain closely watched these negotiations. Like her, the speaker once had accompanied his predecessor when he was a young Katrim. Like her, he belonged to a fire clan and had been born with an elemental talent for languages and insight. And, like her, when he went on his vision journey, he had dreamed of the god Salosa. Now, by watching him, she continued to learn what it meant to be chosen by the one who crosses between worlds, who sees in all directions. Though the hawk, the raven, and owl were all associated with death, Salos-A was not a killer like the hawk, or a trickster like the raven. The owl conducted souls to the land of the sun and was a restless wanderer who acknowledged no boundaries.
End of the first part of Fire Logic, Chapter 1. Written and recorded by Laurie J. Marks. Copyrights 2002-2007. All rights reserved.